Well, good Sunday morning. It's Tommy Howe, 107.7 The End. Welcome to another edition of Tree Huggers International, a weekly environmental affairs program for the listeners of 107.7 The End in Seattle and all of Western Washington, from the Columbia River to the San Juan Islands. Be careful and use this show with caution, because you might just learn something. We all know Sasquatch is going on this weekend at the Gorge in the middle of the state, right along the Columbia River. And while Sasquatch is a relatively new Northwest tradition and phenomenon, a long-running community tradition continues right here in Seattle this weekend in our own front yard at the Seattle Center, the annual Northwest Folklife Festival. And joining me this morning is Michael Hershenson, the Executive Director of Northwest Folklife. And Michael, I appreciate you coming in on what is probably one of the busiest times of the year for you. Welcome to Tree Huggers International on 107.7 The End.
I'm really glad to be here, and thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, it's great to have you here, and I'm glad it worked out for this Sunday, too.
Yeah.
You know, as a former Queen Anne resident, I used to live right at the hill from Seattle Center, and I always considered Seattle Center part of my sphere of influence. You know, it was always part of my neighborhood, and it was always fun whenever folk life was going on when I was living there, because you can just wander in and wander out and take it in however much at a time you want to. And it was a fun place to meet people and see people you'd seen the year before and otherwise. And it really is a community. How long have you guys been doing these festivals?
Well, let me just say one thing first, that you know, you don't have to live on Queen Anne to walk on in from all over Seattle. And we really have sort of evidence of all of that in our regular employees, all of whom walk from Capitol Hill, from Queen Anne, from Ballard and Fremont. So it's kind of interesting that way. But getting back to your question, Folklife has been around since 1972, so this is the 36th festival, and it's, I think, shaping up to be one of the very best ever. Certainly, we've had great weather, and that makes a huge difference, let me tell you.
Yeah, so, I hope the weather holds out for you guys, you know, for the rest of the weekend. In fact, my my knucklehead buddies and I, we even shot a short movie at Folklife a couple of years ago, and just sort of guerrilla did it, ran into the fountain, and I had a buddy of mine who would just go in and just sit down and just start playing guitar and playing sets, and it was just such a laid-back, fun atmosphere there that there's a lot of creativity going on.
One of the things that has surprised me in a fun way is how much of Folklife has ended up on YouTube. So it's just pretty incredible that, you know, people come and they feel free to be there. It's a totally open environment. And interestingly, over the time that I've been at Folklife for about 9 years, and over the time that I've been there, it's just become a younger and younger crowd. And so we're really, and that's in terms of performers as well as audience. And so it really is a free and open environment where people feel really comfortable. I think in large part because, you know, although we ask for a donation, and this year a $10 donation at the entrances to the Seattle Center, so many people come for free, and they don't feel awkward about just walking in and having a good time. And that's what we're there for. It's a really community endeavor.
Well, I think that's really important, too, the fact that this is a free festival, and you almost can't emphasize that enough. Right about now. I mean, all these other festivals that happen at Seattle Center, Bumper Shoot, etc. I mean, you got to have your tickets, and you got to have them early.
Right. It's expensive to do that. And one of the things that we don't talk about enough is the fact that all the performers are playing for free, and they're not getting paid. And they come to Folklife, and they share their music, and they share their traditions, and they share their art, because these are audiences which are so completely different, so huge compared to what you get in a little hall in Issaquah on Thursday night. There are these groups around town that live for Folklife. Folklife is the culminating event of the year, because they know they're coming to Seattle Center. There's going to be a huge crowd, and not just their fathers and sisters and mothers and brothers that they normally run into. So it's special in that way also.
Wow, I didn't know that. So every artist is playing there, and it's a charity. They're playing for free.
That's right.
It's great exposure, obviously.
Yep. And yeah, and we have occasionally, we will get a grant, and we're able to bring an artist from another community to Folklife. So for example, a couple of years ago, we did a focus on it was just last year, on the Arab communities of the Pacific Northwest. And in working with that community, they said to us, if you really want to represent our tradition, you've got to bring, I've forgotten the person's name now, this musician from Toronto. And that was you know, just fantastic that we were able to get, you know, find a grant to bring this guy here. But that's one of 7,000 performers. So that's, the numbers are a little bit hard to fathom there. 21 stages, 7,000 performers over the weekend, you know, so it's really a big, big deal and a big endeavor.
Are there any comparable festivals like
this?
Well,
there's one, I think, which comes close, which is the Smithsonian Festival in Washington, D.C. It also is free. It's very different in two things. One primary thing is that the entire cost of the festival is underwritten by the United States Congress.
Right.
I wish I had that deep pocket.
Good source of funding.
Yes,
sure.
Yes, that works. And the second one is that their festival tends to be curated. So you have programmers, people who are trained in folk arts and folk music and folk traditions, crafts, and they go out and they choose the people who are going to best represent their community in Washington, D.C. Here, we turn to community advisors from the communities and say, hey, come on down and you determine in the community how you want to be represented. So it's a much more of an outside in than an inside out, if you want, kind of a organizing principle. So in a word, folk life is really, really, really special.
Yeah, and very particular to this community as well.
Totally, yeah.
Now, did the festival begin like this, where you're going out to different parts of the community and saying, we want to have you guys represented here, or did it sort of evolve?
Well, I think the scale has evolved. When you go back and you look at the 1972 program from the first festival, and it's this, you know, mimeographed piece of paper, and you look at it and say, oh my gosh, they really got it from the get-go. They really did just raise a flag and say, come on down if you want to play, or send us an application. And now, of course, we've gone from that kind of casual kind of sharing of information generally in the communities to having an online application. So I mentioned that there were 7,000 performers in about 800 or 900 performing groups at the festival. Well, this year we went to online application, which I must say is ecologically incredible. You talk about tree hugging. We used to send out like 3,000 10-page applications. Last year we sent out a little 3x5 postcard. We said, go to www.nwfolklife.org and apply online. We got 1,400 applications online. Really, in that way, the sort of transfer from paper to electrons, if you want, is really an incredible aspect of our work that's been very expensive to pull off and extremely rewarding in that sense.
Yeah, it's very ecologically sound. I mean,
you know, it's true. You know, I didn't make that part up, but still, at the same time, I do think the computers have led us to generating so much more paper than we ever using so much more paper that would be, if we could go paperless, it would really be wonderful.
Yeah, I'm having toner issues with my printer right now. I can't seem to get a good print on this thing.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I know what you're talking about. Are there any other environmental aspects that are unique to folk life this year?
Yeah, well, there's to this year. I actually brought with me a description to make sure I got it right. So first of all, a couple of years ago, there was this employee at Seattle Center who got a master's degree at the University of Washington in some public policy aspect. And he chose as his dissertation topic recycling. And so for at least 5 or 6 years now, we've had a major recycling program for glass and paper and the standard Seattle stuff. But we had special locations on the grounds where people could deposit their bottles and the merchants could throw away paper and stuff like that. Well, this year, we've moved it for the first time a couple of yards further. Now we're going to be composting at the festival.
Oh, yeah.
All the food, all the soiled paper, and all the food scraps. So we're really moving into a world where the gestalt of the festival, if you want, is really becoming increasingly ecological. And you know, it's I think it's a long way to go before people all come in electric cars.
Yeah.
At least the people who are delivering stuff. I sure would like it if more people took advantage of the shuttle buses. You know, we have these buses that come from Northgate. You can really get, if you can get to Northgate, you can take a bus. And there's so many, many bus lines that come to Seattle Center. Well, you said you lived on Queen Anne. You know, there's like the 2, the 3, the 4, the 13, the 15, the 18, the 26, the 5, and even the 358 going down Aurora. There are just lots of buses that come to Seattle Center. And then there's my favorite ecological way of getting, well, I have two favorites. My most kitschy favorite is the monorail.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And that, I just think, is a... And it's running.
It's running this week,
yeah. Hopefully, we won't see what happened. It was at Folklife that it caught on fire a couple of years ago.
Oh,
we won't talk about that. But the other thing that's really wonderful is that, you know, there are bike racks everywhere. There is actually only one major north-south bike route in Seattle, which comes down across the Fremont Bridge and then up across Dexter.
Yeah.
Well, you know, so you got a bike. It's painted, you know, but, you know, you can ride your bike to Seattle Center, and certainly on the weekend. And we just had last Friday was Bike to Work Day. So now we can call it Bike to Folklife Year or Years, and it would really be really phenomenal to see people doing that, as long as they wear their ANSI helmets, right? You know, pompously tell folks that I'm a bike commuter, and then they say, "Oh, wow, that's amazing!" You know, and how old are you, and all this kind of stuff. And I say, I give them my age. And they, "Oh, that's so wonderful!" But what I try to omit is that it's 0.6 miles from my house down Queen Anne Avenue to Seattle Center where I work, and then the ride home is, you know, gets my heart beating. But
then you're home.
Then I'm home. Right. That's true. So. You know, biking is really another really important transition that's, I think, happening not as quickly as I'd like. And I also think that biking keeps you young. I have a friend, a woman who has worked with us at Folklife, who she too has been a bike commuter. And so Liz is a little bit younger than I am. And her father is about 96. And he rides a bike all the time. So, and he says, he's convinced, he's this former doc, and he's convinced that riding your bike keeps your brain sharp. You've got to watch out for all those cars, the number two buses and everything, and you're using your brain in creative ways all the time when you're on your bicycle, just keeping those synapses going. Oh, the car's hitting, this morning going down the hill, some guy pulls out practically in the middle of Queen Anne Avenue, and, you know, and you've got to be prepared to deal with all those things. And so I'm actually thinking about getting disc brakes on my bike now. But anyway, enough of me.
Well, keeping your head sharp and riding your bike, and I guess doing crossword puzzles, you know?
Yeah, that's it.
But that all kind of ties into the whole going green angle of Folklife.
Absolutely.
Which is on the website. And of course,
we are encouraging people to take the bus. We're encouraging people to carpool. And there actually is a city policy that's being slowly and somewhat, I wouldn't, it's explicit, but it's also surreptitious because nobody's talking a lot about it. But all of the planning for, let's say, the future of Seattle Center sees people getting to Seattle Center and getting around Seattle on mass transit eventually. And so, you know, there's actually this movement to reduce the number of parking spaces that are allowed now in that are acquired rather in apartment houses, forcing people to have fewer cars because they can't park them. And then, you know, I'm not sure if these strategies are going to work. We'll see. But I mean, like even coming over here today, you know, I crossed the trolley along the Lake Union trolley from downtown.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, there is an aspect to it that's one could contend that it's serving a rather narrow slice of the population in the city. But I think if you look at what happened in Portland, and this trolley has the potential of eventually going to Seattle Center, what happened in Portland is they started with this trolley, they came up with an economic model that's really, really different, and they're using the same model here. And in addition, that since that trolley, and because it's also cheap to build these trolleys, I can see it expanding to Seattle Center with the Century 21 plan for Seattle Center, which is really a greening of Seattle Center. You'll see that really happening over the next 20 years, I think. I really think that both Seattle Center, the city, and we at Folklife are really encouraging this notion of mass transit and making that to be an efficient way to live in the city.
Portland has always just been very, very progressive about that. And Seattle always seems to lag behind. And I can't tell if it's sort of this not in my backyard sort of attitude or what, but Portland just seems to get it done, and they get it done well.
My sense of that is Portland was with the MACs on the sort of the cutting edge of, that's a heavy rail system that really goes all out in every single direction from the inner core. I think that there's pretty good evidence that Seattle got caught short after World War II. There were a whole bunch of systems in place and some unwise decisions were made. And so as a result, we have been behind. On the other hand, geographically, being kind of constrained between these two bodies of water makes it, it's more complex in that sense. But there's a lot of analysis can be done around mass transit in Seattle, because I think we're just getting it with Sound Transit going out to the airport and these systems.
There's limited space here, but, you know, it's like around World War II. I mean, for heaven's sake, you could go from Olympia to Everett.
Right.
All on streetcars.
Right. Well, it was the Red Line. There was the Red Line was maybe L.A. There were trains, actually, that went up and down. That was, and so, in fact, all of our neighborhoods were started by using trolleys. You know, there was a trolley up Yesler over to Madison Park where you caught a ferry across the other side. Finney, Mr. Finney from Finney Ridge, that he built a trolley line that, and he built the zoo in order to get people to take the trolley to see the real estate that he was selling on either side of the tracks. So there was a lot of that kind of entrepreneurial use of rail early on, and it kind of lost out to the automobile. Here, pretty seriously, I think, about the time of the World's Fair, which in fact created the space, the 1962 World's Fair, which created the space for Folklife and for Bumbershoot. You know, Seattle Center is really this unusual child of World's Fairs, because most World's Fair sites got abandoned. And Seattle Center was just kind of turned into something really productive. And so it's special in that way. I mean, it's our only inner city park, really. And it's a green space that's I cherish, because it's in my backyard, not only because I work there, but because I live on Queen Anne.
Oh, yeah. Seattle's fortunate. We've got a lot of really good parks in this town. This city was developed at the right time, where there was an interest in public spaces like Volunteer Park and Cary Park. If you're just joining us, this is Tree Huggers International and 107.7 The End. Michael Hershenson, the executive director of Northwest Folklife, is joining us here in the studio this morning. My name is Tommy Howe. And Michael, you know, we've been talking about this, and these days it's sort of trendy to be eco-friendly and make sure everyone is aware you as an entity are doing your part to keep the environment clean or pick up after yourself in the form of, you know, being carbon neutral. But Northwest Folklife has always had this very eco-friendly attitude and vibe about it, even when it wasn't necessarily hip, and doing so in a very unself-conscious manner. Has popular culture or society perhaps caught up with some of the ethics of Northwest Folklife?
You know, this is a complicated question, because I would love to say, oh, of course, you're absolutely right. We were on the cutting edge, you know. But I think there are a number of factors right now. I really do believe that global warming has caught everybody really by surprise. I do think that in 1974, when there was this huge, the gas crisis, we didn't have gasoline. Everybody was, there were these long, long lines of cars all over Seattle. And all of a sudden, people started buying economical cars. People, I can remember, buying storm windows that, you know, you're supposed to we were really, really conserving energy in a way that was really, really focused. And my background is actually, or part of my background is in historic preservation planning, which is essentially the conservation of historic buildings, which, and we talk about their conservation as a quality of life issue, but it actually was in very much in this early 70s, we talked about preserving buildings as an ecological, an environmental piece. There were these, that we had the poster for 1974 for the National Preservation Week showed a historic house in a big gas can and saying, this is what you can save by, you know, think how much gas is burned moving new construction materials around the world or around this, wherever you happen to live. And by preserving buildings, you can preserve energy and not burn up gas. Now, think about when Folklife is founded in 1972, part of something which was called the outdoor recreation movement and bringing outdoor recreation into the heart of the city, because you couldn't ask everybody to get in their car and drive to Helangon in order to be outside. You had to find activities within, you know, easy reach of people's homes. And so that really is the underlying root of Northwest Folklife in terms of its as a political policy. Create reasons for people to stay in the city so they don't drive all over the country and burn up all this gas. Now, that's in the early 70s. So in that sense, we were way ahead. On the other, and the other thing one could say is that, or that I could say, is that I can't believe how incredibly regressive things have been since the late 70s. And the introduction of these SUVs, and I won't tell you what Phil Williams, who is the founder of Folklife, calls them, you know, these big cars going back to being, it was one thing in the in the 50s, when I was a kid and everybody's driving around these big fat Cadillacs and these huge Chevrolets to just gobble down gas. When I moved to Seattle in 1970, a long time ago, there was a gas war at the intersection of Lake City Way and 15th. There were gas stations on every corner. There are no gas stations there now. And we paid 25 cents a gallon for gas. And that lasted for a long time. And nobody was thinking about conserving. And it was just after that everybody started thinking about it. So there was a big shift. I mean, everybody was talking about conserving energy. And now it's come back as a public policy rather than as an economic issue. And I also think that $4 a gallon is going to change a lot of people's minds about how they use their vehicles and why, you know, concerts that are 300 miles away are going to be really hard for folks to get to, and it's going to consume a lot of energy. And so staying here, coming to Folklife, you know, starts at 11 o'clock today and runs till 10 o'clock tonight, and the same thing's true tomorrow on Monday. So it really is a way of being, you know, using energy conservatively and in an effective way.
Besides, this time of year, you don't want to leave Seattle anyway. This is why you live in Seattle,
right,
so you can enjoy it this time of year.
Absolutely.
You know?
It's just so nice. And, you know, and this, and not only that, and I'll mention Beth, okay? Beth is the miracle woman at Seattle Center, because she has a budget of $30,000 a year to keep Seattle Center in beautiful flowers and maintaining the environment. She's the chief head gardener there. And she does a fantastic job. It's really a beautiful place to come and visit. And their budget is incredibly tight for such. They got 72 acres to take care of. And I think, as you see also over time with this new Century 21 scheme, there will be an increasing greening of this space, and some of the hard surfaces will disappear.
Something I think our listeners may not be aware of is that there's more to Northwest Folklife than just this annual festival. And can you talk about what Northwest Folklife does the rest of the year?
Well, I would point out one thing that's one of the underlying factors. People always ask me, "What? This is a full-time job?" and quite frankly, 7,000 performers, a free festival, we have to raise about $1 million a year. So a lot of my energy as the executive director goes into raising the money for Folklife. That's for the festival. But programmatically, there are a number of things. We have a recording program. We have made CDs that we sell, and we have to produce them. That's kind of small, not a big part. We also have some educational outreach programs. One's called Rhythm and Moves. And it's a program which we take into after-school programs for middle school kids and high school kids and teaching them dancing. We've been doing African dancing for the last couple of years. And it's we've gotten some support for this program, so none of the children pay for it. We're always trying to find these programs that we can bring to inner-city kids at no cost, because they're the ones who really need to build the kind of self-esteem that comes from expressing yourself through music and dance. We've been collaborating with some wonderful people at Rainier Beach High School for the last 2 years. Mm. So Rainier Beach High School comes and performs at Seattle Center, and they have this wonderful multicultural program. So we're going to see Samoan dancers. We're going to see hip-hop singers. We've seen, you know, a whole bunch of really exciting performances at the festival that are created through programs that we've supported year-round. So that's a big part of it. This last year also, we did a documentary film festival that was in the new SIFF venue, Seattle International Film Festival venue at Seattle Center. We were the first ones to use their space, and we're contemplating doing something like that in next year as well. So we're always looking for these new programs that make people aware of the folk art traditions in the Pacific Northwest in different venues throughout the year. They tend to be of a much smaller scale than the huge festival, though.
You know, Michael, unfortunately, we're starting to run out of time here. Ah. And I wanted to talk real quickly about some of the vendors, because that's always a big thing about Northwest folklife. You've got craft vendors and music vendors and food vendors.
One of the things that's really neat about all of them is that, generally speaking, all of the vendors actually are juried by peers in their communities, or, you know, we have a jury of people who run restaurants who come in and assess the food, determine whether or not it really is representative of the community that it says it's representing. And so, I mean, it's kind of hard to say that about the pizza guys, but it is certainly true to talk about the West African man who comes up from Portland selling West African food. And so there's food from all around the world. You know, it is, you know, kind of festival food, but it tends to be pretty interesting compared to what you certainly see in your average mall.
Oh, that's why people go to Folklife half the time.
The crafters are all from the Pacific Northwest, and they all share goods that they make themselves. You know, there's just nothing that the crafters sell that's not made of their own hand. There is something we call the uncommon market, which is imported goods, but things that have been handcrafted around the world and brought to Seattle as representatives also of those communities that we are showcasing, if you like, at the festival. I just want to invite everybody to come on down today and tomorrow. There's going to be a old-time fiddle contest this afternoon at 2, and that's going to be really great. I'm really excited. I've decided not to participate this year, but that's the way that goes. And then there's going to be a cultural focus on cross-cultural experiences along the Canadian Washington, or the British Columbia Washington border. And so all day there are a whole bunch of Canadian performers and people from places like Winthrop and Twisp, and then way out in the eastern part of the state, coming to perform at the festival and sharing their traditions that many of us. There's even a cowboy poet coming from Winthrop, and he's
cool.
He's really neat. He's one of these, you know, big guys. He worked as a fireman. He's really buff. You know, he's probably about 60, but he's really, you know, a real charmer, and he's
right.
Got this charisma, and he gets up and recites this poetry that, you know, he says is his way of capturing and sharing what it means to be a cowboy in Eastern Washington.